Hello and Happy New Year. I'm Fiona Taylor and welcome to the Organic Gardening Podcast. It's our first episode in 2025 and we're recapping on what an interesting year 2024 was for organic growing. It feels like it didn't stop raining in the UK. Slug and snail damage was one of our favourite subjects to talk about and we enjoyed some fantastic late harvests. It's been a great year for the Organic Gardening Podcast. In August 24, we hit 1 million listens. That's a million people who've downloaded this podcast since we launched in 2019. We've interviewed some brilliant guests, visited some fantastic gardens and outdoor spaces, from River Cottage and the Beth Chateau Gardens to the WWT at Slimbridge. And we discussed plenty of your questions in the postbag. Which brings me on to this month's episode. We're looking back at the postbag from 24. We featured some of our favourite questions, from suspicious strawberry piles to soil health, and there may be some bits you haven't heard before. Enjoy. Right, so first of all, what treatment do you suggest for treating box tree caterpillars? I don't have a problem yet, but I understand they're on their way. This is from John. Well, thanks, John. Yep. Golly, you're not wrong there. They will definitely be on their way. So, first of all, Anton, what are box tree caterpillars?
So, it's a type of moth. So, you either see the moths or you'll see the caterpillars. The moths are quite pretty. They're white with a black margin round the outside. So, unfortunately, when you see one of these pretty moths, you know that your box is doomed. and the caterpillars, I mean, they're sort of greeny with black stripy black dots on them. You'll notice that they've munched most of your box away. They overwinter as sort of small caterpillars under the leaves in your box bush. And then you'll notice in about sort of March, April time, they'll start sort of munching away at the leaves. And you'll just see basically half of the bush has been sort of stripped away. And you also see sort of webbing there as well. And they have several generations throughout the year and they'll carry on right into the autumn, just munching away there.
Yeah, it's not good. I've lost all of mine, as I've mentioned several times on the podcast.
Me too.
So when did it first come here?
So apparently it first arrived in the UK in 2007, but generally gardeners started to notice it, firstly in London particularly, perhaps because there's a lot of sort of box hedging around there, in 2011. And it's gradually spread around the southeast of the country. There's been various surveys done. So they did a survey in 2015 and that covered sort of a lot of the southeast. And then by 2021, you could see that it's covering a lot more of the southeast. It's sort of creeping into the Midlands, and then you see sort of various patches in other places, some quite far north as well. So it's coming to get you, unfortunately.
Yeah. Is there anything John can do to deter them, or is it just one of those things where you just have to wait and cross your fingers?
I mean, if you've got a good bird life population in your garden, that's going to help. But I think they seem to proliferate in such sort of large numbers once you get there that I think it's going to be really quite difficult. You can do some monitoring as well. I mean, there's various sort of measures you can take against it. There's a number of sort of biological controls that you can use. So there's a parasitic wasp that's called Trichogamma. And what that does is it at the wasps, they're tiny little black wasps. You can hardly even see them. And they will sort of lay their eggs inside the box tree moth eggs and stop them hatching out. Mm. Instead, a wasp hatches out. They're little parasites. So they gradually sort of multiply then. So you can get these on little sort of cards or sachets that you hang on the box bush and in the foliage. And they will release these wasps for about 4 weeks.
Right. Okay.
Also, there are nematodes as well, but you need to spray those directly onto the caterpillars. And you've also got to be quite careful under the conditions as well, because it's a nematode, basically, and the nematodes don't like the sunlight, so you need to spray them early in the morning or sort of late in the evening. And it does work out really pricey after a while. Like each treatment's about between 20 and 30 quid. That's going to really quickly mount up, and that's probably, you know, after a few treatments, you could have bought some other plants to replace
the box. I think it's fair to say that the box tree caterpillars have kind of got the best of us, I'm afraid. But there are lots of alternatives. So, Chris, talk us through what you did in the past when you've had this problem.
Well, I came across it a while back when I was head gardener. So, I mean, I'm very much in the belief. I kind of understand people have this big nostalgia for box because it's kind of sort of ingrained in the English garden psyche in many ways. And it, you know, we've had that knot gardens and the traditional gardens and even cottage gardens, it tends to ring front. But I'm a big believer that if something's not working, just change it about. There's so many good plants out there that you can play around with. So I'll give you my three top tips, I think. When I was at Westminster Abbey, we did a knot garden and we had a lot of problem with box not coping. So I used a plant called Lonicera nitida. Now, Lonicera is the genus of the honeysuckle. You think of it as a climber with flowers, but this is a shrub, quite box-like leaves. There's one called Baggerson's Gold, if you want to have a bit more variety to it, aesthetics to it. But it just makes a great box-type hedge. And so I plant that in diagonal. I plant them about 30 centimetres apart, but I wouldn't put them in a straight line. I put them on the stagger. And it's a very fast-growing plant, so it soon fills in, okay? Give it a good mulch, give it a good composting before planting. The only downside with it, I didn't mind this too much, but some other people might, is that it grows very, very rapidly. So to keep its shape, so if you're in a knot garden like I had it, you need to keep it trimmed all the time. You're probably out there every 3 or 4 weeks with the shears. It's quite fast growing. So that's maybe a little bit of a warning if you're going to use a Lonicera nitida. I think it's a great plant, probably the most vigorous and strongest of the alternatives. There's another one called Ilex pronata. This is like a Japanese. Ilex is the holly genus. Actually, in the wild, I've seen it. It gets like 5 meters tall. It's a big old plant. But Wisley have done trials and used it as a box alternative. Very sort of waxy, light-coloured green leaves. We'll get fruit on it, red fruit on it, if it's allowed. Depends how often you're pruning it. But that's another one. I'm told it doesn't like very, very wet weather. So us in the UK might not be able to choose it at the moment because it hasn't stopped raining for about 6 months. But I think that's, if you're in a sandy sort of soil, light soil, I would maybe go for that, okay? A final one would be an old classic, would be Cotoneaster conspicuous, which everyone knows a Cotoneaster, a very common sort of park, a front garden plant, very similar to one called Horrentalis, which everyone used to plant at one point, which grows up walls and stuff. But that is a brilliant one for bees and birds. It's probably a bit more slow growing. You'd have to clip it a bit more delicately, but I think that would be quite a nice alternative to box as well. Also, I mean, if you're a bit more adventurous, why just have a monocultured small hedge? Why not, you know, pick all different types of plants that stay low and undulate them and have lots going on? I think I quite like the idea of that.
So mix it up. We need more diversity in our planting. Get rid of the monocultures. There's lots of things you can do. There's all sorts of options. Embrace the opportunity to branch out, I think, is the advice from here. While I've got you, gentlemen, I wanted to ask you about green manure. So on a recent broadcast of Gardener's Question Time, green manures were rather dismissed. I don't know if you heard this programme, but the general consensus of the panel seemed to be that green manures can get very tough and fibrous, and then it's just all a bit too much hassle to dig them in, and actually they don't really bother with green manures. I don't want to libel anybody, but that was the impression that we were left with. So I would like to just have a quick chat with you in defence of green manures. Obviously, it's a bit late in the year now to be sowing them, but I wouldn't want to put people off them because we know them to be fantastically effective, brilliant for soil health. So first of all, let's deal with the problem. One of the green manures, perhaps it's Phacelia, gets really tough, it's germinated well, it's grown strong, and then it just all just feels a bit too difficult to deal with. What would you do in that instance, Anton?
So if you've let it grow too tough, you've probably obviously left it a little bit too long, but still not all is lost. You can just hoe it off and put it into your compost heap. Right. There won't be so much benefits for the soil, because you're taking away some of the goodness, but you still protected the soil over the winter, which is the most important thing. Ideally, you want to try and get them when they're a bit younger, and then you can just cut them down and drop them onto the soil. I tend to mix them with a bit of compost as well. It's also your choice of green manures as well, because I think some of them were sort of more designed for agricultural systems where people had a rotavator. So I find particularly grazing rye, which is one that's often promoted in gardening catalogues, I think it's quite a difficult one for gardeners to use. So I particularly like things like Phacelia, vetch, as long as you get it quite early as well. Just feel it with your fingers sort of every week and just make sure that it's still soft and lush. Once it's starting to sort of toughen up, then it's probably time to chop it down.
Okay. But the method is to just chop it and let it do its thing and let the worms bring it into the soil. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, they probably, I mean, I don't, it's a shame maybe they're trying to avoid it because it means digging, but I don't know if I agree with that really, because like Anton says, I grow mustard, you know, I like to grow mustard as a green manure, and I just hoe it off basically. Mm. So I'm not doing any digging at all. I'll just hoe it off and let it rot down in situ.
Yeah.
The timing is essential. If I leave it too long, then it gets pithy, and that's the first year I used it. That's what I found out. To be fair, though, I just chopped it up and put it on the compost heap, so it wasn't wasted.
Yeah, no.
But it's just timing. So, like you say, do a finger test, make sure. You don't want to get it to flowering stage, because then it'll start to pith up then. The lignin will get into the cells and you'll get a tougher plant. So that's timing, I think. And also, I mean, you could just cut it down and lay it there, won't it? And it will, especially if it's an annual, like a mustard, it will just rot away into the soil. I'll be interested to know if they don't want to use green manures, what their alternative is. Are they putting carbol down or something like that? It seems to me a biological presence would be better than an artificial one, is what I think it would be.
Yeah. And then just remembering, I guess, that, you know, if it's an annual, it's not going to take over. It's not invasive in any way. So all you need to do is literally just chop it down and it does it for you.
A hoe is perfect. Yeah. It'd take me 30 seconds to hoe a little bed of mustard down, and I just let the soil, the worms pull it in.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, now, Hannah has said she's read conflicting advice on whether to feed birds all the year round or to stop during the spring. And what would we recommend? And I'm quite interested in this because I think we all probably have slightly different views on this. So, Chris, first of all, what do you do?
Well, I stop. I stop in sort of late May, early June, after they've fledged.
Right.
I will say, this time of year, they're just the light of our life at home, because everything's just full of them. And we're kind of up in the trees, you see, so we get all their nests really close to us. So it's like a constant fly, blue tit, great tit, a lot of robin, get wren up there even. Just incredible. But I am in the top of the trees, and what I noticed in the late spring, you start to see a lot of fly life and life in the trees themselves. I'm sure they're full of caterpillar as well. So I kind of play the hard parent, really. I go, well, it's time to pull up your braces and feed yourself, I suppose. I will get into a massive discussion with it with my wife, because we just love having them around.
Yeah, so anything you can do to have them coming, especially when they're all fluffy and...
Oh, at the moment, it's just like, oh, it really hits your heartstrings, it really does.
Okay, so you do stop, but you also, you stop partly because you're in the canopy of the trees, I understand that. But I think there's also a philosophy behind stopping that actually you want them to feed on, the caterpillars that are on your plants, presumably.
Yeah, well, so a lot of some gardeners will say that. This is a grey area, it's important to point out. And some gardeners will say, I want them feeding on the blue tits, I want them eating the cabbage white caterpillars, I want them, you know, feeding off the plants, a more natural way of doing it. And I kind of understand that. I think maybe, I don't know if you're doing any harm by carrying on feeding. I doubt you are very much. Maybe that's a personal approach or how you want to play it, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it also depends on the kind of garden you have.
Yes.
Yeah, and Anton, I mean, what's your philosophy on this?
Well, I must admit, I do carry on feeding them. From what I've seen, the jury's a bit out there as whether you should carry on feeding them or not. From what I've seen, it's said that it's not actually going to do much harm. There's always this sort of thought that, oh, they're going to get lazy and become dependent on you if you carry on feeding them. I just from my own personal point of view, I just see these parents doing loads and loads of journeys a day, sort of picking all the grubs off the plants, and I think they must need some sustenance. So
your parental sympathies.
Yeah, brilliant.
So my other experience is when I have stopped feeding them, we do get a robin that comes right up to the window and gives us a really hard stare.
You know, I tell you that. Sometimes I get when it pops up over the window.
I give in to him, I must admit.
I can understand that. Most people would, wouldn't they?
I mean, I know from my experience, there is plenty of food source in my garden. But, you know, perhaps if you're a gardener that doesn't have quite so many plants in their garden and perhaps things are a little bit, a little bit more Spartan, or perhaps you've got a piece of concrete that you're gardening on, then perhaps it is a good idea to keep it going all the year round because you haven't got many other food sources that you can offer.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, I think we also need to take a sort of balanced picture and look at what we can have in our own gardens as a sort of mixed food source as well. You know, sort of, we used to always tidy up before the winter, but now we leave all the sort of heads on the plants.
It comes into the whole biodiversity thing. Yeah. You want to create as good a home as possible for your wildlife. And that in turn hopefully creates a balance between what you're trying to grow as well.
And it's amazing what they will discover, you know, things that you don't necessarily cut down. You know, I've got loads of lemon balm in my garden. I absolutely love it. And the goldfinches just love the little tiny seeds at the top. Have you noticed any favourite plants that the birds particularly love?
Well, I am a big grower of sunflowers on the allotment because they're good for their bees love them as well. I grow them out the front of that block as well because the kids like growing them. So it's quite a nice little communal thing. But I then harvest all those seeds and I get a big old load out of them because I grow quite a lot, especially the butch, the Heliophis gigantica, the big sunflower. And the birds absolutely love those, you know. So I can, not only can they feed on the plant, but I'll take them off and use them into the winter as well.
Yes.
And you put them out in the feeder and they are gone straight away.
Yeah.
They devour them so quick. Teasel's another good one as well on the allotment for the blue tits. And there's plenty of stuff around for them. I think, like you say, you just need to include your planting. That's right. Yeah. Sunflowers for me is the, so I get double bubble. I get the beauty of the sunflower and I get happy birds. What a win-win.
Yeah, I find teasel's particularly good for the goldfinches. Also, I find something like the climbing rose has got quite a few aphids on it, and that seems to be a real magnet for the blue tits. I get a few surprises as well. We've got a little goji berry, and for some reason that seemed to attract quite a few goldfinches. I don't know why.
Yeah, lots of different opportunities then for birds. So don't forget to plant with birds in mind. One other point, though, is that a lot of us buy bird food in. And any views on that?
It's quite a tricky one, really, isn't it? Because you don't know where it's coming from quite often. I mean, sunflower seeds often a lot of those, certainly when I see in the shops, a lot of it comes from China as well. So
I think if people are out there, there's people out there, there probably will be small company who are doing sustainable bird food. That's what to look for.
Yeah.
And they'll rummage around on Google, see what's out there. But you're right, it's difficult because you don't really get that information, do you?
Yeah.
And it's big business, bird food, billion.
Yeah. I guess look for labels that reassure you. You know, if the RSPB are recommending it, it's probably okay, for example.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, thanks very much.
So, do you have any advice on how to get rid of moss on vegetable plots? The plots aren't raised but have wooden surrounds and the moss has been getting worse over the years. I live in Devon, which can be damp a lot of the time. Well, let's stop and think about moss for a minute. Anton, first of all, what is moss?
So moss is quite a primitive plant which sort of thrives under really damp conditions. It's very shallow rooting and it reproduces through spores, which usually they form in the spring and sometimes in the autumn as well. And so people often worry if they are going to be sort of pulling it up or putting it in their compost that they're going to be spreading the spores around. I think that's something that's quite difficult to avoid anyway. What you really want to do is try and make sure that you don't recreate the conditions that's really favourable to moss. You want to try and sort of, basically you've got a drainage problem and you want to try and sort of alleviate that.
So they like it damp and dark or light, or how does that work?
They tend to thrive a little bit more under darker conditions,
right.
But that tends to be just because those conditions tend to be damper. The water hasn't evaporated from the soil surface.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's quite interesting that it's coming back year on year, but obviously it spreads quite easily because of the
spores, as you're saying, it's not that difficult to pull it out, presumably. Yeah.
It's very shallow rooted.
Shallow rooted, because there was another question about whether it has roots or spores that go deep into the soil. I suppose the spores, do they survive over a winter?
As far as I know, they would do. They will probably survive in your compost as well. But like I say, if you haven't got the conditions where they thrive, then it isn't really a problem.
It's
the conditions that you need to be modifying.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's quite interesting to think that on a veg bed, you've got moss. I mean, I imagine it in, you know, dark corners, and I've got it in various corners of my greenhouse. But it's quite difficult to imagine it in an open vegetable plot. As you say, not too difficult to get rid of. A fantastic resource, though, moss. I mean, what would you use that for, Chris?
Well, certainly I do use moss quite a lot. If you've got a lawn that's on heavy clay, it's more likely you'll get moss in it because, obviously, as Anton says, it's a drainage problem.
Yeah.
So I would certainly use it in my hanging baskets. That's so it's a sustainable sort of source, isn't it, in many ways. But it is there. It's an indicator to me. So if you're getting it in your veg bed, it means it's not draining properly. So it's not. You don't have to worry about spores. That's irrelevant. It's about stopping the conditions, as Anton says, in the first place.
Okay.
So I wouldn't worry about putting on the compost bin or anything like that. But what I would try and do is aerate my soil. That's what I'm going to do. You might also, the bare of the soil, if you're leaving bare soil over winter as well, you'll get a thing called capping, where the soil locks on the surface and stops the drainage going through, the water moving through. Moss will love that. It's perfect for moss conditions.
Okay.
So maybe a green manure, a mustard, something like that might help that. Also making sure, that soil's composted. The same rules we always say, keep that soil nice and healthy, broken up, get the leaf roots in, let the water move through it, and that moss will just give up then. It'll go off and find that dark corner you was describing and grow over there. It's about, you don't want it in your veg bed.
No.
So make sure that soil's draining okay.
They do have their place, though. I think they are the most lovely plants. I absolutely love them. I mean, you of course, have some fond memories of them from your time in Japan.
They're just such beautiful, beautiful things. They really are. And you grow them in Japanese gardens, you'll see them. They're a very important part of it. You'll see them growing on the rocks and the stone, and they'll grow in the shady conditions where there's a lot of water movement. And they're very beautiful. There's a guy at Chelsea, isn't there, who does them every year, where he just does these amazing balls of moss. And they've got their place, but you don't want them around your carrots. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. In an effort to reduce digging, I've covered the vegetable plot with cardboard, weighted down with about 2 inches depth of quite well-rotted wood chip. Some of the wood chip was yew. Can I sow seeds or set out plants directly into the mulch, or will there be some kind of deficiency as a result of the wood chip mulch containing some unrated material? You know, so there's a lot of nervousness around this, isn't there, with wood chip? You're not quite sure what's in it and how to use it. So, Anton, how do you allay some fears around this?
So, with wood chip, generally, you want to wait till it has composted pretty well if you are going to be incorporating it into the soil and sowing seeds into it, because it really can soak up some of the nitrogen as it's still being broken down. The bugs, basically, as they're breaking down the wood, will need nitrogen for that process. It's okay to use unrotted wood chip as a mulch if you're not going to actually stir it into the soil. That's not such a problem. So I'm slightly nervous about what they've done here, just because they're actually sowing seeds straight into it. I think they should probably, with hindsight, should have let it rot down a little bit more. It might be a problem more in the first year. It will probably be less of a problem later on. But all is not lost. They probably just need to top up the nitrogen levels a bit in that soil, because obviously they've got a bed now and they want to use it. So they probably want to add something that releases nitrogen fairly quickly, like comfrey pellets or alfalfa pellets. You might even need to liquid feed the plants if they're starting to struggle. That's not something you'd normally want to do in a veg bed, but on that occasion, you might need to do that.
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting. So the wood, when it's new, it's just too young. We always talk about let things rot down, everything's got to be well rotted, everything's got to really start fermenting, and then it's going to really do some good. But I am quite interested that if you've got a flower bed perhaps that you're not really going to touch and you can just lay it over as a mulch, that's fine. But actually trying to garden with it, you know, yeah. with it in place, it is a problem. Chris, have you got any observations around this?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Anton. I would be patient personally. I would want it more rotted, particularly if you're planting young plant seed or even young plants. I would find a nice hard spot on the allotment. I could think of a place on my own allotment. I would stack it on there. I'd probably turn it a few times through the course of the summer and I'd get it to break down, keep moisture in it as well, try and accelerate that process and look to use it the following year, I expect, or as a mulch in the late winter. I'll probably, maybe if I've got a compost spare, I might mix it in with that as well to help degrade it even more. But yeah, so if you've got something like yew, yew's a very hard wood. It won't break down quickly. So you are kind of tempting fate a little bit for a nitrogen deficiency. The other thing is, if it's following year and you can use it, maybe use a sieve if you're sowing seeds into it to make it finer. But I would give it a bit of time personally.
Yeah, okay. So no quick fix here. But, you know, interesting nonetheless. And if you've got a stash of wood chip, it's good stuff. There's no doubt about that. It just has to be well rotted.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Question from Emma. I've read that I should avoid leaving my soil bare over the winter. Why is this and how should I protect it? Yeah, it's a good question, this, because we're at that time of year where you might suddenly notice that you've ended up with a bit of bare soil without meaning to. So, Chris, can you explain, first of all, why it's important not to have bare soil?
Well, there's a few reasons, really. Soil structure being the main one. Obviously, if you get heavy rains, etc., we don't tend to, where I am in London particularly, we don't tend to get frosts anymore, which will break the soil up. It's more likely to heavy rains than you get a capping, so the water runs off and you get damage, but also mainly leaching as well. So if water moves through soil, it will take the nutrient with it and wash it down to the subsoils, etc. So by protecting it, I keep those nutrients up in the top of the soil where I want them to be for my cropping. And it's interesting because I don't like to see any bare soil at all. So I have sown mustard as a green manure. There's quite a lot of that on there, but there's always patches coming up. Still got a lot of salad crops on there and I'm taking them out. So I've got ball patches coming up there. So I would be looking to protect that soil, stop the leaching, stop the structure getting damaged, basically. And then the water, the heavy rains causing damage.
Okay. So as you're cropping and you're discovering, you know, or laying various patches bare, what do you then use to cover those patches?
Well, I can use a few things. I might use cardboard, literally just cardboard if I can. If I've got it, I'll use leaf mould. I'm quite sparing with that because it takes so long to break down. But certainly some sort of protection to stop that, the top of the topsoil getting any kind of damage.
Okay. Anton, you're a big green manure expert. Are we a bit too late for green manures in November?
I think so, really. I mean, at a pinch, you could try growing field beans, but I mean, the germination is going to be pretty slow at that time. And actually, field beans works out quite expensive because the seed's quite big, so you need quite a lot of them. And I think really you're chucking your money away because you're sowing something that's quite pricey and that's probably not going to germinate very well. That's the problem with green manures, is that you do need to
sort of August, September time, you've got to really be thinking about it, haven't you? Yeah. We often talk about mulching. It's a big subject for this organisation. We love our mulch. We often talk about mulching with garden compost. Again, is that advisable this time of year?
Personally speaking, I am a mulcher in the early spring, sort of early Marchish time. And there's a reason for that, really. I think if you put good quality compost down, it's going to have a lot of nutrient in it. Again, the same problem. I'll bring back leaching. If it's raining, that's going to get washed through and you're going to lose all that nutrient. So coming from the point of view that the compost is our black gold, if you like.
Yeah.
I like to be very sparing with it, but I like to use it at the right time. And I think if you're putting on compost in March, the soil's starting to warm, all the organisms and the worms, etc., are going to pull that compost into the soil and you're not going to lose. You'll benefit from it massively, I think. I remember when I was at Kew, they were mulching heavily in the autumn and there were problems with leaching. There were problems with it changed the pH. The pH got altered. It wouldn't break down. So actually the bed started to get higher after towards the end of the year, as it wasn't being pulled in. So I'm definitely, unless I'm trying to protect a tree fern or a very sensitive plant, I might mulch then. I would mulch at the end of the winter, early spring, when the soil then becomes active again.
Yeah, okay. Fully understand. So really, this time of the year, it's more about covering the soil.
Protection.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any benefit to leaving weeds in situ? I've got plenty of them, so I'd be interested to know the answer to this. Anton?
Yeah, I think it's a great thing to leave some weeds. I mean, basically, it's a free green manure. It's just doing the same job as a green manure, but you haven't had to pay for the seed. So.
Some of them are quite nice. Like things like speedwell are quite common. I get on my allotment, and that keeps flowering in the winter. You'll see the odd flower on it, and it doesn't do much harm. It's quite easy to remove. Chickweed's another one. The only thing I'd avoid is probably like yourself, pernicious weeds like my horsetail, my bindweed, my couch grass. I don't really want them to overwinter because they'll get away nice and early in the spring. But anything else, you're exactly right. Why, if it's not doing any harm, let it sit there and let it protect them. Protect your soil.
I think the challenge is going to be on allotments when you've got the sort of allotment aficionados coming round and with a clipboard and telling you that you haven't kept your plot tidy. But hopefully people are being a little bit more relaxed over things
like that. I think maybe people are a bit more understanding of biodiversity and troubles with pollinators and stuff. So hopefully, yeah, but you're right. It depends on a lot. Look, we said before, allotments are microcosms of humanity. So if you get the wrong committee, you mean weeds out. So it just depends, isn't it, on the site you're on. But I mean, nothing wrong with a bit of speedwell, is there? It's a nice little plant.
I mean, there's weeds and weeds, though. And I mean, we have talked on our website and in the organic way about weeds being a really good indicator for aspects of your soil health. Can you expand on that a bit, Anton?
Yeah, I mean, so obviously different weeds have adapted to growing in different sort of climates. They've got their own little sort of niches, really. So things like chickweed and nettles tend to grow on more sort of nutrient-rich soil. So if you've got a lot of nettles there, it's a sign you've got a really sort of healthy soil. And then things like creeping buttercup. If you go for a walk in any field, you look towards the gate, you'll find a lot of creeping buttercup right near the gate, and that's because it's been trampled a lot, so that shows that soil's been compacted. So that's a really good one. And then there's lots of others as well. So a lot of the perennial weeds like creeping thistle tend to prefer a sort of heavier soil, because you've got that little bit of sort of rhizome is less likely to dry out on a sort of heavier clay soil. Having said that, a lot of weeds do break the rules as well. They don't sort of look in a textbook to say where they're going to go. You'll find
they're colonizers, aren't they? They move in where we don't go. And so,
opportunists.
Yeah,
definitely. But a great way to observe your garden and to see what's going on. And from my point of view, the idea of not having to pull up weeds during the winter for good reason is well, that's just brilliant. That's made my day. Right, another question here. We're on to strawberries now. Can you help with an issue on my strawberry patch? The strawberries are being taken off the plant and being piled up in small clumps, either within the strawberry patch or to the side. The patch has been stripped of all fruit over several weeks. Do you know what it might be and what I can do to avoid it next year? Quite interesting behaviour, this, from something or someone. Anton, any clues?
I'm just taking a guess. It sounds like the behaviour of a crow or a rook. They do seem to like picking things out and then making little piles of them.
I love the idea of a crow pantry.
I remember talking to this farmer once and he said, it must be quite boring being a crow all day. So this is why they do this sort of thing.
So they pile them up. Do they come back for them?
And they might do. I mean, I have more commonly seen it done with plants. And the reason they do that is because they're looking for the leather jackets and other sort of grubs underneath. Okay. So they're not actually interested in your plants, but they're quite tidy. So they just put them in a nice pile at the end of your row. But the strawberries, perhaps they are making a little stash to come back to later.
Okay, but we think it's bird behaviour, bird damage. Chris, you have a lot of bird damage. We often talk about pigeons, don't we?
Yes, my nemesis.
Yes. Just how can you protect your fruit against birds?
I agree. I definitely think it's birds. Crows and rook, they're very clever birds, aren't they? They've got an intellect. So they obviously, there's a little plan going on, I reckon. Yes. But I'll give you a real life example. I put a strawberry bed in a place I'm working at the moment, and it's raised sleepers, one sleeper high, and the strawberries went in and they were getting attacked. So I just put chicken wire. That would be my solution.
Yeah.
You can net them, but netting's quite a lot of faffing. You know, you've got to take it off to weed, put on. Whereas with chicken wire, you can just tack it in one end of the sleeper and then roll it out and tack it down. It's very malleable, so you can move it around. Maybe lift it about 6 centimetres, 10 centimetres above the plant. I think that'll stop it. I really do. It's not a very expensive way to stop it as well, so it's quite cheap to do. chicken wire, I reckon, is the
most. Okay. Now, last month, we had a question about strawberries being picked and put in piles. And the general consensus was that this was being done by birds, specifically crows, actually, I think we decided. However, we've been contacted by a couple of listeners who beg to differ. So firstly, Lucy emailed in to say, this is definitely the work of voles or perhaps other rodents. When I lived in a town with lots of cats around, it wasn't a problem. But now I'm living the good life in the country. I'm finding out what a menace they can be. I don't have cats for the sake of the blue tits that keep the aphids under control. But rodents are the price I pay. Well, we're quite fond of voles here, Anton, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that you're doing a service to our sort of cute furry friends. So, yeah, I have had rodents do those sort of tricks as well. They particularly seem to do it with beans as well. Broad beans, I've seen them piled up as well. And yeah, I mean, who thinks about it? But voles just want to have fun, don't they?
I don't know, I had so organised. I'll just leave this pile of fruit here, but I'll stack it first.
I wonder if they come back for it. I mean, it is a wonderful kind of notion, isn't it?
It is, I really like it. I'm almost like feeling help yourself.
Yes, it's like you created your larder and yeah, you can come back for it. Okay, so Heather emailed with a similar response. I've just listened to the July podcast and the question about strawberries nipped off and left in piles was asked. I have that problem, but it's definitely not the birds, as they're covered securely with fleece. Not all the fruit have been picked, and it did include the green ones. I thought it might be mice. What do you think, Chris, on this?
I feel sorry for the crows that we blamed completely.
Yeah, sorry about that. Slanderous.
I know, we'd be sued by crows if we're not careful. Well, it sounds, it could be well rodents, it could. I mean, yeah, without seeing it in operation, it's very difficult. But if they're going under the fleece, then maybe it is. I mean, mice will, you know, they've got good appetites, haven't they? I didn't ever find them stashing stuff somewhere, but maybe if there's an abundance of food, that'll be the case. That could well possibly be right. I think if you're having big problems with this, I mean, mice will chew through things anyway, so I don't think netting or anything like that's really going to help you. I think maybe try and grow them in a different substrate, in a different environment. So in schools, we put them in drain pipes, upright drain pipes. You just drill a little hole in all the way up, block the bottom off, and then you can plant straight into that, which is great because nothing's getting out, and they're not the slugs either, so they can grow that. All as I do on my balcony, I put them in hanging baskets, so you wouldn't get a massive crop that way. But I like strawberries organic grown, because you only get that one, two crops a year, but they are just so wonderful.
Oh, it's just wonderful.
They're just so, but yeah, so try maybe if you're really struggling, if the mice are being that organised and stuck in pantries, then try hanging a basket.
Well, the great thing about strawberry plants is, of course, they put out a whole fresh set for you at the end of the season. So next year you can take a different strategy, can't you? Yeah, fantastic. We've got a question from Viv, who's got a rose that's not very well. So she wrote to us, I have a David Austin Wild Edric rose, which has been with me for many years in a large pot. Earlier this year, it was repotted to an even larger container and it thrived with more flowers than ever. However, after coming back from a few weeks away, my neighbour was watering it, but I found it in poor condition. Many of the leaves had a speckled, rusty covering and the rosebuds themselves had withered. Any idea what's wrong with it, what I should do to get this much treasured plant back to good health? Gosh, well, I'm going to ask you first of all, Chris, because I know you've got a huge affection for roses.
I love it, especially old English roses. This is an English shrub rose, very, very beautiful. I would have a place for it in my garden, to be honest with you. Yeah. So I can understand the sentiment. I would say to Viv, don't give up on it.
Yeah.
I'd say that's rule one. I think it's become stressed, and like most stressed plants, they're much more vulnerable, a bit like people. If we get stressed, we're more vulnerable to disease, we're more vulnerable to it. So if it's watered and fertilized, as it's in a pot, healthily, it might not be in this position, but it is. But it's not time to give up. Rust tend to be host specific, so the rust will probably attack in that rose particularly. I would probably look at definitely giving it a decent haircut and giving it maybe a nice thick layer of well-rotted horse manure onto that pot. Cut out any dead or diseased material and let it go again the following year. I think they're quite resilient plants. I mean, the shrub roses are just great because you can plant them in herbaceous borders and because they're quite low and they just flower quite heavily. If you deadhead them, they'll keep going. I mean, they're very, very beautiful plants. So I would not, It's stressed. You've got a stressed rose.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always going to have an additional stress to it by being in a pot, you know.
Yes, it's more variable. If it dries out particularly, because the roots are just going to suffer far more than if it was in the ground, especially if it's in a terracotta pot as well, which tends to heat up a little bit. Yeah. So I think that's it. And the thing is with container garden is if you take your eye off the ball, things deteriorate quite quickly. Yeah. That's just a fact. So, but I think there's quite a resilient plant, this one. And I think that if you feed it, you know, get the soil right, cut it back hard, take the D and DDD it, make sure it's all the disease materials taken out, burn the leaves, get rid of the leaves, because obviously the leaves will overwinter the rust as well, probably. So, don't give up on it, I'd say.
Can you just give us that DDD again?
The DDD is dead, disease and dying material.
The dead, disease and dying material. Okay. Anton, just talk us through a little bit more around rust, black spot, the kind of things that roses are susceptible to.
So the rose rust, you'll notice it's got sort of orange spores for the beginning of the season up until the summer. Those are the ones it uses to spread to other plants. And then later on, you get more sort of these sort of black spores on it, which then those are the ones which are the resting spores. So fungi often have different sort of stages to them. So it forms these resting spores, and those are the ones which will then fall into the soil or go onto sort of old plant material and overwinter. So you really don't want to be spreading those around. So like with black spot as well, the main things you can do against these fungi is to make sure you cut off any dead material, like Chris said, any sort of disease material. But also sweeping up all the sort of old leaves as well, because they're a sort of big reservoir for all the sort of disease material. Those are the sort of two main things. I mean, these diseases, they have bred some resistance to them in varieties, but unfortunately what tends to happen is that the disease gets wise to this, and about a few years later that sort of resistance breaks down. So wild edric used to be resistant to rose rust, but the rose rust has got wise to this now. So
you continually need to observe and clear away anything that's looking not well, and then get rid of. And presumably you can't then put that in the compost heap, I assume.
No, I wouldn't. That would definitely be a
something
way
you would
overwintering it.
Yeah, okay. All right. So really clear then, Viv, you need to be continually deadheading. That will get the best out of your rose. You need to be watching for any diseased or dead leaves and remove those altogether from the plant and don't compost those. Give it a good cut back because it's tough enough, this particular rose, we think. And good luck. Let us know how you get on. That's all we've got time for this month. Thanks so much to you for listening to the Organic Gardening Podcast during 24. We hope you have a great start to the new year, and we'll see you again in February when I'll be back with Chris and Anton for the next year of podcasts. If you've been out in the garden over the festive break and you've got any questions for our postbag, please email us podcast@gardenorganic.org.uk or message us on social media. That's @gardenorganicuk. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks so much to Kevin MacLeod for the music. We'll see you next time.